Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, brought to you today by Sanebox. Bring some needed sanity to your inbox with a two-week free trial. Plus, if you sign up through us, you'll get an extra $25 in credit at sanebox.com/martini. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim Garrity of National Review is here as well. And Jim, sanity or lack thereof is a common theme in today's Three Martini Lunch because we have crazy, crazy, and crazy martinis for our listeners today. Let's begin with the first crazy, and that is going to be Donald Trump's post-election plans. He probably shouldn't have any if he's actually serious about winning this thing, but one of the rumors that's kind of been out there with not a lot of substantiation now has a little bit of substantiation. This is from the Financial Times of London, and it's the lead item in the Morning Jolt today. Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has informally approached one of the media industry's top deal makers about the prospect of setting up a Trump television network after the presidential election in November. Mr. Kushner, an increasingly influential figure in the billionaire's presidential campaign, contacted Arya Burkoff, the founder and chief executive of Liontree, a boutique investment bank, within the past couple of months, according to three people with knowledge of the matter. Their conversation was brief and has not progressed since, the people said. Mr. Burkoff and Mr. Kushner both declined to comment. And Jim, between the blow-up at Fox News with the Roger Ailes and certain Fox News personalities who are seemingly more loyal to Trump than perhaps their employer, like somebody in the 10 o'clock slot. There's been some rumors out there this is going to be happening, but whether any of those rumors are actually true or not, the fact that somebody that close to Trump is having those types of talks just a month before the election is insane.
Well, I was going to say, wait a minute. Greg, I don't know about you. I'm hearing from people, Trump fans all the time. He's going to win. He's going to win in a landslide. He's totally going to win. It's a done deal. All of these polls are skewed, Greg. They're all lying. You're probably in on it, Greg. I bet you the Financial Times is too. Not that, you know, we can start off our Monday venting our spleen at people. But let me observe this. Like, if he really, if, you know, presuming this conversation occurred, and they say they're quoting three sources, neither Kushner nor Burkoff chose to, you know, give an on-the-record denial of this conversation. You know, then it appears that the rumors of Trump TV that have been circling for a while, there is some substance to them, that this is something that Trump is looking at. So one of two things, either Trump is daring to acknowledge that he might not win in November, something that a whole bunch of us have been saying, that he was on a bad course for a long time, and occasionally you get a little bit of wind of his back, but generally he's been the underdog through the entire general election. And if you're beginning to make alternative plans, well, I mean, there's some people who would argue, wait a minute, you really shouldn't spend any time between the end of the primaries and Election Day 2016, contemplating what you do if you lose. In fact, you should be planning your transition, planning to be prepared, going all out, leave it all on the field, 110%. I mean, the moment you're making, here's what I do in case I don't win, is an indicator that you're not 110% committed to this. And the idea that this entire presidential campaign has basically just been effectively a giant publicity stunt, effectively just been an effort to kind of build an audience for Trump, is probably unnerving and chilling, and as you said, crazy. One other thing I'd say, I made this point in the jolt, how do you think Fox News feels, Greg? Having generally given Trump better coverage than the other cable networks and giving him, you know, really intense round-the-clock coverage. Now, when you say Fox News has been more sympathetic to Trump than other cable networks, Dio, that argument looks stronger if you're looking at the Sean Hannitys of the world. It looks weaker if you look at the Megyn Kellys of the world. Fox News is not a monolith, but quite a few Fox hosts were very sympathetic to Donald Trump. And now he's getting the ideas that maybe this whole presidential campaign is designed to set up creating a rival network that will inevitably eat into Fox News' audience. And who will be running that whole thing? Oh, Roger Ailes, the guy who's been, you know, who helped build Fox News to what it is. This election turned out about as bad as humanly possible for Fox News. And that by giving generous coverage to a guy, he got the nomination and then turned the entire presidential campaign into a kind of dress rehearsal for a future cable news network to compete with them. We also probably should point out, Greg, there's a little bit of doubt. Do you see Trump really wanting to get involved in the day-to-day decisions of running a television news channel?
He's the big picture guy, though.
He is the big picture. It's more, I think he wants to host, right? I think he wants to have the Trump show. I don't think he wants to run a network. He'd like to have his name on a network, I think. But I think he likes to be on camera. Or at least phoning it in. Trump loves to be in the spotlight. And in fact, the irony is that, you know, it's very few people could pick Roger Ailes out of a lineup, and very few people have seen televised interviews with Roger Ailes. I mean, I don't think Trump wants to be Roger Ailes. Ironically, I think he wants something akin to O'Reilly or Sean Hannity's job. I think he wants to be on camera giving his thoughts on the events of the day. He's free to get that, but he shouldn't use a presidential campaign to do that. So anyway, but then again, I guess it worked for Huckabee, huh?
It did for a while. Oh, man. And the right will stay divided because, the loyalties for each of those networks, if this were to actually happen, would probably break down on whether you like Donald Trump or not. And Jim, you might need to dust off that daily schedule from the Trump TV network that you came up with a few months back.
The fun question will be, how many people did I put in that satirical parody of what Trump TV would look like actually end up on Trump TV, presuming Trump TV comes to pass?
Oh, quite a few, I would guess. All right, on to the second crazy martini now. And while most of the mainstream media has been completely consumed with the audio tape from Access Hollywood featuring Donald Trump, as well as the numerous women now that have come forth to allege that he sexually harassed or sexually assaulted them in some way, the Hillary Clinton scandal that keeps unfolding day by day, email by email, is the WikiLeaks scandal. And the media has been reporting on this, but certainly not with the volume or anywhere close to it that they've been reporting on the Trump scandals. But now, just when you thought that media arrogance couldn't get a whole lot higher, you've got Chris Cuomo on CNN reminding everyone to just calm down. If there's anything important in there, he'll let you know, because you can't look at it because it's against the law.
Also interesting is, remember, it's illegal to possess these stolen documents. It's different for the media. So everything you learn about this, you're learning from us. And in full disclosure, let's take a look at what is in there and what it means.
So, Jim, how comfortable are you knowing that everything you need to know, Chris Cuomo will let you know about?
Yeah, particularly about his brother's Andrew's scandals, huh?
Yes, sure.
Mom always liked you best. I've been thinking about this because I wrote a couple corner segments summarizing what we were finding in the WikiLeaks emails. Now, John Podesta may be this kind of craven, Igor-like henchman to Hillary Clinton. He may be a guy we will beat around like a pinata all day long. But I actually feel a shred of sympathy for the guy, because if you went into anybody's emails and exposed them all for all the world to see, chances are you'd find something in there that they would not like the whole wide world to see. Insults or snide comments, moments where they lost their temper. We've seen plenty of that from John Podesta. Having said that, I'm not committing a crime by writing about them. In case you're wondering, for any listeners out there, anybody, you can look at WikiLeaks all you want. You are not committing a crime by looking at them. You are not committing a crime posting about them, writing about them, talking about them. I don't believe, even if there was classified information, the crime that has been committed is by WikiLeaks and by anybody who either leaked the information or who, the equivalent of electronically forcibly intruding into the systems and hacking to do it. Those are the folks who are committing a crime. You are not liable for anything by discussing what you find in these WikiLeaks things. I do kind of wonder if there's an ethical line that is crossed by this. But having said that, I think we have a hard time believing that if there were Republican emails that were hacked, they probably would be posted all over the place. And it is genuine news. We are learning things we did not know. We did not know that Hillary Clinton had pretty much made up her mind on trade authority. She said, I want to see the final print before I make a decision on it. No, she already decided it, because the unions were pressuring her. Chris Cuomo, the guy who once insisted that, yes, there really was a provision in the Constitution that said you couldn't yell fire at a crowded theater, and then, speech can be incendiary, and obviously not all speech is protected. For a guy who didn't know the law there, I guess it's not that surprising he doesn't know the law here, Greg. I just kind of find it fascinating that the guy who works in media with a law degree is so completely oblivious to the actual laws regarding the media and the First Amendment.
He just likes to make himself sound more important.
No, torts or something, or contract law. Okay, fine. But media law, you'd think that would be what he's good at. And that's what he keeps getting wrong, apparently.
Yeah, he just likes to make himself seem more important. What would be very helpful if WikiLeaks would do is to separate the emails, because we're getting so many of them, into different categories. You've got your defaming the Catholic Church scandals. You've got your Wall Street speeches. To keep all this stuff straight, because so much is coming out, might be a suggestion there for Sanebox.
That is a good segue. And yes, by the way, said WikiLeaks really does need SaneBox because they're terribly disorganized. It's very tough to go through them and actually find something useful. So, you know, WikiLeaks are fantastic hackers, bad editors. I think it's an overstuffed email box that's their problem.
It could be. So,
and they're criminals and they're Russians and all that. But beyond that,
in light of that, let me ask you a question. How many emails do you have in your inbox right now? Is it 100, 1,000, 20,000? If your email is anything like mine used to be, the answer is way too many. But here's the thing. Even though I knew I wanted to do something about it, I didn't know exactly how until we had this opportunity to work with SaneBox. I knew I'd miss something important if I just deleted all the emails, but there were too many emails to go through one at a time. So what do you do? As a result of our relationship with them, I got to play around with SaneBox, and it finally let me in on the secret to reaching what they call Inbox Zero and taking back your email sanity.
It's called SaneBox, and I cannot recommend it enough. SaneBox sorts through your email and moves all of the trivial stuff into a different folder, so the only messages in your inbox are the ones you actually want to see. Aside from moving all the junk emails so you can focus on messages that matter, there's this thing called the black hole. Move an email into that folder and you'll never hear from that sender again. It's so rewarding. Greg, how many people email you that you never really want to hear from ever again?
Quite a few, actually.
Yeah, picture your head moving the actual person into a black hole. They scream, ah! We all use SaneBox and it worked out a great deal for our listeners.
So visit SaneBox.com/martini today and they'll throw in an extra $25 in credit on top of the 2-week free trial because you signed up with us at that site, SaneBox.com/martini. You don't have to enter your credit card information unless you decide to buy. So really, nothing to lose. Check it out today and let us know if you love the black hole and reaching Inbox Zero as much as we do. Again, that's SaneBox, SaneBox.com/martini, SaneBox.com/martini. So as we said, Jim, it's crazy, crazy, crazy today. And some listeners may remember that a couple of weeks ago, we actually gave a shout out to millennials for the simple reason is that their numbers of people who were definitely going to vote this year were cratering because, you know, in case you haven't seen, the candidates are pretty lousy to choose from this year. But our time of being nice to the millennials has come to an end. The Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation released its first annual report on U.S. attitudes toward socialism today. The survey showed a distinct generation gap regarding beliefs about socialism and communism between older and younger Americans. For example, 80% of baby boomers and 91% of elderly Americans believe that communism was and still is a problem in the world today, while just 55% of millennials say the same. But the numbers get worse. Just 37% of millennials had a very unfavorable view of communism compared to 57% of Americans overall. Close to half, 45% of Americans aged 16 to 20 said they would vote for a socialist and 21% would vote for a communist. When asked their opinion of capitalism, 64% of Americans over the age of 65 said they viewed it favorably compared to just 42% of millennials, which in case you missed it, is lower than the number who said they would vote for a socialist. Finally, and this is perhaps the most horrifying part, the survey also revealed a general lack of historical knowledge, especially among young adults. According to the report, one-third, 32% of millennials believe that more people were killed under George W. Bush than under Joseph Stalin. Jim, we're failing somewhere, probably in a lot of different places, but that's inexcusable.
Yeah, and that one reflects two things that our culture does not do well. The first part is understating the death toll from Stalin and the horrors of communism. I feel like if you said, you know, who killed more, George W. Bush or Hitler, I'd like to think the young people would get that. I'd like to think that at some point the idea of 6 million Jews being killed in the Holocaust, the idea of millions upon millions of people being killed in the Nazi wars of aggression and invasions of neighboring countries, that would have permeated, that people would know that and say that no matter how, if you want to count every death in the Iraq war and attribute that to George W. Bush, you still wouldn't equal the death toll from the horrors of World War II.
Not even close.
I'd like to think they'd get that. Maybe they don't. I'm always struck whenever I read about the horrors of the Stalinist era and really running all the way up almost to Gorbachev. I mean, you know, the gulags and secret police and torture chambers and show trials. And you go down the list, I'm struck by the number of people who know almost nothing about this. And it doesn't come up in our culture. I don't know if it's because I have this theory, Greg, that when you're studying American history in high school or maybe in earlier grades, you start at the beginning, like colonial America, pre-colonial America. You work your way up, and by spring starts coming around, you get to about World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And everything after World War II gets rushed in the final week or two of high school. And you skip over all that important stuff. And you miss so many important things of our history. So the biggest blind spot in our culture is from when the end of the history book in high school, which I think in my history book ended like Vietnam or so, all the way to whatever the years up to when we're aware of what's going on in the world. And admittedly, Greg, with millennials, maybe they're still not aware of what's going on in the world. You reach this point where they don't know what happened then. And then the second thing is they have this idea of what, you know, this overinflated sense of the terrible horrors of the Iraq War. Now, war is all hell. And undoubtedly, there were a significant number of civilian casualties and a civil war fighting amongst the Sunni and Shia and Kurds in Iraq. Something I have not noticed, Greg, did you notice that the death toll from the Syrian civil war is now coming up on par with the Iraq war?
Oh, I believe that.
Right? We're told Iraq was the worst thing imaginable. It was the worst thing ever. It was the most, the greatest horror, the greatest war crime, and you know, all this overwrought rhetoric. Well, the U.S. did not intervene, and now we see an equivalent death toll. So maybe the problem wasn't really U.S. interventionism. Maybe this is a part of the world in which the violence and the hatred and the rage has been cultivated and permeated into these cultures for so long that anytime there's going to be a battle, you're going to see horrific violence. It's not to make excuses for warmongers, it's an observation that this is the Iraq War was not actually a historical anomaly, that in fact, if anything, the U.S. fought it with remarkable effort to minimize civilian casualties. Trying to minimize civilian casualties is actually a rarity in modern warfare. Quite a few folks try to maximize those civilian casualties in an effort to break the spirit of the opposition. Anyway, this is what you learn if you learn history, if you study history. And it appears that an enormous number of millennials have done none of this. And I shudder to think what kind of bad ideas they will buy into because they've not looked at history and not looked at the bad ideas that can permeate in ignorance. And, you know, the old saying of those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it. And they don't just mean having to take the class again.
That's exactly what I was thinking, because you see the older folks in those surveys, they remember what happened when it came to Soviet communism and communism all over the place, not just in the USSR. And so they don't buy the arguments that there's this grand government-run utopia out there. But the people that don't remember the Cold War, they're buying into it. And it's up to the rest of us to educate them. So we're trying. So don't be part of those 32% millennials. You can do better than that. We believe in you, sort of. Jim, have a good day.
We believe in you, sort of. Nothing more inspiring on this Monday. See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks to Sanebox for sponsoring us today. Visit sanebox.com/martini, and they'll throw in an extra $25 credit on top of the two-week free trial. But you got to do it through us, sanebox.com/martini, sanebox.com/martini. Join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.